Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Well, what's the expression? The eyes are the window of the soul. Tonight we're looking straight into them. When things go wrong with your eyes, it can be catastrophic. Ordinarily, I suppose, we probably don't think about them that much. Most of us just relying on our eyesight to get around, earn a living and go about our everyday lives without actually thinking so much about them at all. I wonder how often you think about the health of your eyes. Probably in terms of parts of the body, probably not as much as you worry about aches and pains in your leg, for example. You shouldn't wait until your prescription starts to seem a little weak to have a checkup, because some of the most common eye diseases affecting thousands of Australians do not have obvious symptoms until damage is already done. Tonight, we're going to focus on eye health, how to know when something's wrong, and what your options are when things start looking as though they're going a bit pear-shaped. Dr. Steve Colley is an ophthalmologist. He's head of the department at Fremantle Hospital, and he joins us here in the studio. Steve, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Phil.
Lovely to have you in. What's the difference between ophthalmologists and optometrists?
I'm ophthalmologists. We tend to deal with pathology in the eye, so when things go wrong. Optometrists, they look to improve your eyesight when you need glasses. Obviously, extremely important, as lots of patients require glasses, and lots of us require glasses, especially as we get older for reading. And these days, we work together, in fact, because there's just such an ageing population that we all need to be keeping our eyes open, so to speak, to look out for eye disease that we can treat.
How is eye disease generally anyway? Is it worse than it used to be, better than it used to be? You might think with the number of screens we're required to look at these days, things could be worse.
Yeah, we certainly use our eyes a lot, I have to say. But look, I think we've never been better at treating eye disease, and I think, like all areas of medicine, we appreciate that detecting things early gives us the best chance to maintain good vision, maintain good health. So I think a lot of screening gets done. So I think our eye health is as good as it's ever been. But that doesn't stop there from being issues. And, of course, conditions like diabetes are getting much more prevalent, and diabetes is one of the leading causes of eye disease. So from that point of view, certainly there's a significant burden of eye disease in the population.
I only ask the question because we often talk about lifestyle diseases and the vagaries of modern life and what it does to our health. But you would say, in relation to eyesight at least, apart from diabetes, that hasn't been a factor.
It has. But I think the one really great thing in Australia is that our smoking rate's gone down. And that's one of the really significant factors when it comes to age-related macular degeneration.
What does smoking do to your eyes?
It accelerates the wet form of macular degeneration by about tenfold. So from that point of view, it's very significant. And the treatable, the avoidable risk factor for that condition, and that's getting more common as the population ages.
What are the most common eye diseases? What most commonly goes wrong?
Sure. I guess the most common is the reason there's lots of optometrists and lots of ophthalmologists is requiring glasses to see correctly. Prior to glasses, we'd all be squinting around trying to see things properly. So that's the most significant, requiring spectacles. But in terms of disease...
But is that, just to go back on that, because I remember once talking to an ophthalmologist about, my concerns about the fact that I couldn't see things. He was quite, not contemptuous, but he was saying, look, just get used to it. This happens to everybody. It's just an ageing thing, that a lot of people lose the ability to either read or see far, one or the other, as they get older. And you should just get used to that, because that's what life is.
Well, we do have some treatments for it, but I'd have to say that having a pair of reading glasses is not too onerous. I think that's a perfectly reasonable approach.
Yeah. Yes. What about cataracts?
Cataracts are quite a significant issue. And by virtue, again, of the population aging, virtually everyone over the age of 70 develops a cataract. And
what is a cataract anyway?
It's a cloudiness to the lens inside the eye. So the eye is like a camera, and it's got a series of lenses that focus light at the back of the eye. that particular lens is the one that fails in your 40s, so that you need to hold things further away and go into reading glasses. But when you get into your 60s and 70s, it starts to get cloudy and harder to see through.
Hmm. Yeah, and the treatment for that is?
Well, the standard treatment for cataracts is to remove them. It's a quick, painless procedure these days with a very high success rate.
Hmm. And what happens to the eye afterwards?
Yeah, the eye has to heal up, but the healing is very quick. Most people are on drops for about a month afterwards, and after that, they do quite well.
Hmm. You look at sort of the machinery that's on display these days in eye surgery. It does look extraordinarily complex. I mean, particularly laser surgery. I mean, there's been a revolution in the way that eyes get treated, haven't there, with the use of lasers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, lasers have been used in ophthalmology for many decades, but the laser to throw away your glasses, for instance, is something that's been perfected over the last decade or so, and it is very accurate. And patients do very well from it, it does what it says, yeah, so it does work very well.
Mm. All right, glaucoma. What's glaucoma and why does it happen?
Yeah, glaucoma is another one of these very common eye diseases, and it happens by virtue of damage to the nerve at the back of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the nerve, the cable basically between the eye or the camera film layer of the eye and your brain, and pressure damages that in glaucoma. It's a painless condition, so people actually don't know they've got it until it's too late. So that's one of the really significant eye diseases that we screen for a lot.
Because what causes it?
It's a pressure inside the eye. There's a sort of weakness at the back of the eye as the nerves in the back of the eye take a sort of right angle turn.
Mm-hmm.
They're exposed to pressure, and that pressure causes the nerves to die off.
Okay, but what causes the pressure in the eyeball to be too great?
No, that's a good question. The commonest form is just the pressure going up over time,
right,
as you age. But there are other forms of glaucoma where the actual drainage part of the eye blocks off abruptly,
mm-hmm.
and then you can get pain in that situation and very rapid vision loss. But the commonest form is where the pressure just slowly goes up over time, and over many decades your vision becomes more constricted. And people don't know till it's too late. If you came in to see your local doctor and said, I'm tripping over things, and the cause was glaucoma, we would have missed the boat.
Hmm. You say that eyes like a camera. I mean, it sounds a bit more complicated than that, isn't it? You're saying in terms of its basic operation.
Yeah, it's pretty sophisticated.
If we made a camera like an eye, I suspect it'd be quite a fancy camera, wouldn't it?
Well, I think it is. And there's like quite a lot of research looking at implanting chips that are light sensitive into the back of the eye to replace a macula which is damaged to try and restore sight. And it's working on that camera principle. So, interestingly enough, with all this AI stuff going on, there's some pretty sophisticated computer software out there that does the
same
thing.
Yeah, well, we spoke just last week on the program with a researcher about the bionic eye, which has been developed. I mean, it's, you know, it's at this stage a computer in a backpack, pretty much, but at least a number of patients are taking it home to wear.
Yep.
It doesn't make you see, but it does provide some visual sensory input. That is, you know something's there, maybe. Not exactly what it is.
Yeah, they haven't got to the level where you can drive a car with it, but it's, I mean, the principle's there, and it's like computers. It's getting enough of the light-sensitive cells onto a small enough area that you can get that resolution that you need. But it's time, I think. I think they're onto it, so it's something that's going to happen.
Why can't we transplant eyes? We transplant other organs. Why can't we, if you've got a defective eyeball, can't you get a donor eyeball?
Well, you can transplant parts of it. So the front window of the eye is well tolerated. You can transplant the cornea, and that's a very successful operation and been done for many years. But transplanting the back of the eye is like the central nervous system. If you transect or cut that optic nerve and try and replace it with someone else's, it just doesn't grow. So it's similar. You can't graft a spinal cord at this stage. So that's the limiting factor, is being able to hook all the nerves up.
That no one knows how to hook the nerves up again.
Correct, or make them regrow. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, you don't think that will ever happen, given the nature of human tissue, probably.
Well, no. I mean, I've got patients who have lost that optic nerve function, and they want to know about that. There was a couple of years ago, there was a chap with a quadriplegic who had some stem cells from his nasal cavity or the olfactory nerves transplanted into his spinal cord, and he improved function. So I think they're going to get there with that as well, but that's a bit further away than the bionic eye, I suspect.
Hmm. You would say, for the reasons you're mentioning, that regular eye tests are important.
Oh,
I suspect people don't have regular eye tests, do they? How should you approach this? Ask your GP.
Well, I think this is again where optometrists and ophthalmologists work together. So a large percentage of the population obviously need to get glasses and have them updated regularly. And my optometry colleagues are very skilled at screening basic people with normal vision and seeing when the vision isn't normal, where various components of your visual function are reduced, and they refer those patients on to the ophthalmologist, and then we can collaborate and start treatment. So there is a big percentage of the population who are getting screened all the time. I guess it's those patients who don't know they've got trouble, and I think that's where family history is really important. A lot of these eye diseases run in families quite strongly.
Mm. The surgery that's available for eyes is quite sophisticated, the laser surgery and so on. Do you think we've gone about as far as we're likely to go with surgery?
I guess I wish, because I think it works quite well now, but I was at a talk last week where they were talking about robotics, and I mean... people are fallible, and we do a very good job, and we have a very high success rate. But you can always see the computer boffins wanting to try and replace us with robots, and with no fail rates or anything like that. But I think there's always a lot of research into this, and in Australia, glaucoma, for instance, a small subset of patients with glaucoma need surgery, and the surgery for that up until recently has been a tried and trusted operation that's been around for 30 years. But just recently there's been some great advancements in glaucoma surgery, where the surgery is faster. It looks like it's going to be as predictable and quite possibly with lower complication rates. So, look, I think there's always advancements. But cataract surgery, for instance, does very well now.
Mm. I get the sense, I mean, tell me, you're the expert, but I get the sense that a lot of the really effective treatments for our eyes in terms of surgery, et cetera, are the front of the eye where the lens and the focusing issues are happening, and that at the retina, when that light is transferred somehow into electrical energy, which goes down through the nervous system, that retinal problems are another whole box of problems which we don't seem to be as far along the line. Would that be fair?
Well, Phil, I think my retinal colleagues will be onto the phone if I don't give them a plug. Retinal surgery is quite sophisticated as well. And I think by virtue of improvements in the machinery and also the training, some of my retinal colleagues do amazing operations, I have to say. When your retina falls off, these days it can be repaired extremely successfully with a very good chance of restoring vision. So they do quite good work, and I have to say, I think most of the eye we can treat pretty well these days.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about macular degeneration. I mean, you mentioned it earlier. It's a thing that comes up every time we have a discussion about eyes. What is it?
Yeah, macular degeneration is where the macula is the central part of that camera film layer. It's where the cones are most tightly packed.
It's on the retina.
It's the retina.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small spot in the centre of the retina where the cones, which are the light-sensitive cells that see colour and also high resolution, are really packed tightly together. And without your macula, your vision drops off dramatically. You might be able to make shapes out, but the macula is that part of your retina that allows you to read, see someone's face, to drive a car.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extremely important, and it's highly metabolic, and it wears out. It collects waste products that in people with macular degeneration they're unable to clear properly, and that sort of accumulation of waste products damages the light-sensitive cells.
Mm. And the treatment for it?
There are two forms. There's the common form, which is dry macular degeneration, which tends to progress quite slowly. So
why is it called dry?
In contrast to wet. So wet macular degeneration is the least common but the most rapidly developing and most serious. It's called wet because what happens is a blood vessel grows into the macula where the blood vessels are well controlled, and this is a, like a rogue blood vessel that leaks, and that causes accumulation of fluid, and your vision drops dramatically and precipitously. So someone could be going along, doing fine, driving, no problem. They develop wet macular degeneration, and the vision in the eye that's affected can drop down significantly, so such that they can't even see someone's face, for instance. When that happens, that's the critical time to get that picked up, because we can treat it.
Mm-hmm.
So we can treat it. The treatment sounds awful. People have injections into their eye, but it's extremely effective, and it dries the macula out. The blood vessel regresses, and they're back seeing as they were before. And there's a critical period. It's usually within a few weeks that if you can treat that, then patients can go on. I've got some patients where previously they may have lost their driving vision within a month. Now they've been having injections for 7 to 8 years and still able to drive. So that's a huge advance, albeit it's pretty onerous on everyone. It's a lot of treatment required to keep people's eyes functioning with that condition.
Mm. You know, with not everyone, but a lot of other organs in your body, you know what to do to look after it. I mean, if you're in your heart, for example, smoking's bad, obviously. Yeah. Too much alcohol is bad. You know, you should obviously limit the degree to which your blood vessels are clogging up, so therefore worry about your cholesterol. Sure. And your high-density lipids and so on and so forth. So you know how to look after your heart. Your liver the same. We, you know, ease off on grog and fatty foods and other things, and so it goes. What keeps your eyes healthy? Is there anything yeah. you should be doing that... Well, to look after eyes, other than be healthy generally?
Yeah, well, I mean, the good news is all that stuff that works on your heart works on your eyes as well.
Hmm.
And we've talked about smoking. I can't emphasise how bad that
everyone
is
for knows smoking's bad.
Yeah,
Steve, but the entire world knows smoking's bad. Indeed. If you're still smoking, yeah. then like you've just decided that I've got to do it anyway.
Yeah, well, it's so addictive. That's the problem. Hmm. But other things. Obviously, we've talked about glaucoma, where you don't know you've got it till you've been checked. So regular screening is a really important component to that. Take diabetes in the eye. We sort of recommend yearly to 2 yearly checks for diabetes, because if we pick up a problem, we can prevent vision loss. Whereas when you present with vision loss, often you've missed the boat, so it's important to try and get these things early. So I guess that's prevention with eye disease is extremely important.
Hmm. My guest is Dr. Steve Colley. He's an ophthalmologist. He's head of department at Fremantle Hospital. Jane's been hanging on there for a bit. Jane, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife. Hi, Jane.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm very well, Jane, yes. Now, what's the problem?
Is there any new and exciting treatments for very severe dry eyes? And I've got another quick question, if I can, after that.
Steve?
Yeah, sure, Jane. Yeah, dry eyes are such a bugbear, isn't it? There are certainly treatments available. There's some new non-preserved drops out, Hylo Fort, which a lot of patients find working really well if you've got severe dry eye. Other treatments like plugging up your tear ducts to stop the tears from draining away.
No, that doesn't help. They're so bad I have to tape them up at night, or they rip in the morning.
Oh, gosh.
And I'm using drops every, 20 minutes, Cellulovisc and Polygel and Lacrolubin and stuff at night.
So you're doing all the right things, Jane.
Yeah, and compresses and all that kind of jazz. But yeah. Is there anything new and exciting that's really, really schmick?
Yeah, I think the only thing to say is that those new drops, you can get them from your local doctor or your...
Hylo Forte, was that what it was called?
Yeah, yeah. For patients with severe dry eye, that seems to be very helpful.
Oh, okay, great. And one quick one. When I've been to an ophthalmologist and they do the pressure test where they actually touch your eye, I get a massive pain in my solar plexus when they do that. Why that would happen?
Gosh, yeah, no, you might have me with that one, Jane.
Okay, that's all right. It was worth a try.
Well, interestingly enough, the nerves around the eye are hooked up to the vagus nerve, which is the nerve that controls your heart rate and make you feel queasy and things like that. So it's probably something to do with the vagus nerve,
but
I'm not exactly sure, unfortunately.
All right. Well, thanks for the thing about the tears. I'll give them a try. The Forte, I'll give them a try. Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure, Jane.
Thanks, Jane. Bye. Yeah, that thing about the vagus nerve is interesting. Is it true that sometimes when, it's very rare, that when operating on the eye because of that, you can stop the stop the heart.
If only it was rare, Phil.
Really? So it's what? So it does happen.
Oh yeah. Look, one of my specialties is operating on the muscles around the eyes, and three times in the last 2 weeks, the heart rate has slowed down a lot. One time we had one of the anaesthetists a little bit anxious, but they work with me and they know that that's a possibility. So as long as you're aware of it, you're fine. It's when you get caught unawares, so someone who's not ready for it, it can be a bit interesting.
Yeah, there's sort of it's almost philosophically interesting, isn't it?
It's crazy
that your heart, which is, as we know, the centre of life, but it's also as we also know, it does affect emotion a lot. That's connected to your eyesight too.
Well, perhaps it just shows that the eye might be even more important than the heart. Don't tell my cardiology colleagues about
it. No, but actually, that's right. Philosophically, it is interesting. Frank's on the line. Frank, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, folks. Since mid-October, my right eye vision is a bit fuzzy, kind of a halo effect around it. I'm blinking to try and improve the vision. I've been told by an optometrist that I have a detaching vitreous sac, and it is common at my age and will settle down. How long does it normally take to settle down?
Yes, good question, Frank. Normally it takes a few months to start to settle down. In fact, it can start to settle even before that. Some people get floaters ongoing beyond that period of time. But if the vision's really quite hazy, you probably need to get that looked at. There's a particular device which is really useful called an OCT, and that can actually image the back of the eye, and it can detect whether there's any abnormal attachments between the vitreous that you're talking about there and the actual retina, because sometimes there can be an abnormal attachment between the vitreous and the macula, and that can cause disturbed vision in the scenario you're describing.
I think he did do imaging of the back of the eye, because he did some quite sophisticated tests and he showed me 3D views of the back of the eye. And because it's important vision, I just want to be 100% sure that it's something that I can just sort of allow to run its course. I'm just worried that there may be something else going on.
Yeah, sure. So you would expect the symptoms to settle down, Frank. So if they haven't started, how long has it been going for now?
Mid-October.
So it's been going about 6 weeks. So you'd expect the symptoms to start to settle down in the next month. If that doesn't happen, or if they're getting worse, then I'd certainly get that checked further.
And who would I go to, an optometrist or an optician?
Yeah, when it's to do with the pathology, certainly catching up with one of the ophthalmologists would be what I'd recommend. You can go back to your optometrist. He may be able to image it again and reassure you that things are improving. But otherwise, you can either see your optometrist and they'll refer you to an ophthalmologist, or see your local doctor and get a referral that way.
So about 2.5 months, if there's no improvement, further investigation.
Well, I would give it probably another 2 to 4 weeks, but I wouldn't leave it beyond that if things haven't started to settle down.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Good luck with it, Frank. Thank you. Belinda, hello.
Hi. In 2004 or 2002, I can't remember now. I'm a bit old. I had cataract surgery in my right eye. I was only, in the early 30s. Now, since then, I get pixelation in the bottom of my eye. It's almost like a crescent shape, so it goes around the bottom of my eye. And when I get that pixelation, I can't actually drive or anything. It takes quite a while for it to go away. And I'm just wondering what it might be.
Belinda, that sounds like it could be a migraine. Do you get a headache with it?
Yeah, I do get migraines, but I don't get that when I get migraines. I can be, it might be related to stress or something, because when I'm driving my car or anything, it just can happen. You know, I can be sitting around talking and it'll just be there, and it takes quite a while for it to go away.
So how long does it take to settle down, Belinda?
Sometimes it can take over an hour before it goes away.
Yes.
Yeah, so but it comes and goes. Like, it's not every day. It's just something that, you know, can turn up out of the blue.
Yep. So if it's not associated with a headache, most likely, particularly given that you're a migraine sufferer, it's probably what we call an acephalic migraine. So it's kind of like the migraine aura, but you don't get the headache afterwards, which is sort of a good thing. In terms of other possible causes, I mean, sometimes retinal disease can cause similar symptoms, but just if it lasts for an hour, that's very, you know, sort of half an hour to an hour is very typical of the sort of aura you get with the migraine. So that'd be what I think would be most likely. If it's not settling down or seeming to be becoming more frequent, I'd get it checked. So
all right,
catch up with your local ophthalmologist and they'll be able to look into it for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, Belinda, thank you. Chris from Parks. Hello, Chris.
How you going?
Not bad.
I was just wondering whether you've ever heard of an eye condition called Stargardt's disease.
Yes. So Stargardt's, does it run in your family, Chris?
No. Well, no, I'm just the lucky first one to have it.
Oh gosh. Okay. Yes. It's a dystrophy. It affects your macula and obviously can affect your central vision. What sort of symptoms are you having at this stage?
Well, I was diagnosed with it nearly 40 years ago.
Okay. Sorry.
That's right. I just want, and of course, there's still no cure being found or treatment, is there?
Oh no, it's one of the. I mean, that's an interesting area of certainly medicine, ophthalmology, all these genetic diseases. Finding what the gene defect is means that some sort of treatment is possible. As far as I know, and I'm not up to date on this, that there is no trial for Stargardt's at present. But certainly the gene's been well recognised. So it is one of those, and it's a relatively common form of dystrophy. So it is one of those conditions that there's a lot of research into.
Okay. I've learned to live with it, but I was just curious whether there's been anything found for it. But anyway, that's okay.
All right, Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Good on you. Raj in Sydney. Hello, Raj.
Yeah, good, good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, yes.
Yeah, okay. I am about 65 years, mm-hmm. and I'm diabetic for the last 15 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have one good medication, and they say that my diabetic control is good. And I'm seeing an ophthalmologist regularly. They suggest me to go and see him every 2 years. I have a suspicion, is that good enough? Because if anything goes wrong in between 2 years, is that period okay? Like, I keep asking the doctor. Doctor said, yeah, that should be good enough. So what does the doctor say? Not with your panel
law, I guess. Yeah. So Raj, provided your sugar control is excellent, and we aim to get you to have your HbA1c, which is kind of like the measure of good diabetic control, 7 or less, and you've got no evidence of diabetic change in your retina, then a 2-yearly check would be what we would recommend at this stage. If there was any signs of trouble with your retina, so any signs of diabetic retinopathy, or if you had some other disease like renal disease, or you had trouble with smoking or anything like that, then the rate of review would be greater. So it's kind of encouraging that you're at the 2-yearly review, so that suggests everything's probably under control.
Yeah, I guess so. No, I forgot to tell you that my HbA1c is controlled around 6.2, something like that, sometimes 5.8, 5.9.
Yep.
And then my endocrinologist is suggesting that he may take me off even diabetic medication. I'm a bit scared of these things. I don't want to go off medication and end up with problems again.
Yep.
You know, I just wanted to talk to you and see, you know, make sure that I'm doing the right thing.
Sure.
I have no doubt. I mean, suspicion. My specialists are good. I got confidence. But I thought, you know, I was driving, and then I saw this program on ophthalmology. I thought, I might as well talk to you and
You sound like the perfect patient, Raj. Most of our patients, we fight to get them to stay on their medication. So good on you for taking care of your health. But the other thing you can do is you can obviously catch up with your optometrist in between times. So if you had your ophthalmologist seeing you every 2 years and you had your glasses checked every year off the other side of that, then you'd be getting a yearly check. So that might be another way of looking at it.
Okay,
you might end up with more glasses.
Good luck, Raj.
Thank you so much. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, no, likewise. We're with Dr. Steve Colley, ophthalmologist, head of department at Fremantle Hospital. Paul from the Hunter Valley was listening earlier about our caller who had the aura. Hello, Paul.
Hi, how are you going?
Well, thank you.
It's just a bit of a story with the episode. I had that same thing, and I think it was called a castellated sarcoma. But I didn't know it at the time when I went to the GP, and he put me off to an ophthalmologist who did all the tests, and I think it was the old-style glaucoma test where they actually touched the eyeball. But then after a couple of days after going to that ophthalmologist, I ended up getting what I found out later was a viral conjunctivitis. And none of the GPs in my area knew about it. The nurses were irrigating my eye to try and get the sand out. Ended up having to go to another ophthalmologist 2 weeks after the first one to tell me that it was a very common thing. And I was just surprised that no one knew about it, that it was in the region. You know what I mean?
Oh, yes. But.
But it's interesting that I don't get a migraine, but I do get. I ended up getting the letter that the ophthalmologist sent my GP. He said sarcoma, and I googled sarcoma, and then straight up it started talking about this castellated sarcoma.
Hmm.
But I'd be interested to know a bit more about what is viral conjunctivitis.
Oh yes, look, you're talking about adenovirus as well. It's an awful virus to get in your eyes because it really does cause quite a lot of pain and discomfort. It typically heads in the community. It hides in the community in kids from school age and younger, and they get a respiratory infection and a cough, and generally their eyes look okay. But if an adult gets the same virus, it seems to have a propensity to head for your eyes. And you get these bright, beefy red eyes. It's just awful. Patients are in tears with it, and it's a very painful disease. It tends to be self-limiting in that it settles down after 1 to 2 weeks. Occasionally you can get deposits in your cornea that can make your vision blurry, and you need to go on to anti-inflammatory medication. It spreads like wildfire, and we down at Fremantle Hospital, at one stage, we had an outbreak, and a whole bunch of patients got it. So you need to be vigilant as an ophthalmologist to try and avoid giving it to all your patients. It's
just a lot of the GPs didn't seem to know anything about it, and the ophthalmologist later sort of said, you know, I could have picked it up and pressed the button that went up to his floor on the lift. And I'm thinking, well, if he identified that as a risk of getting it, why didn't he? The Glen 20 or something to wipe the buttons down after each person.
Oh, dear.
You know what I mean? Because I must have got it from that or the glaucoma test, and no one knew anything about it.
No, I've had it a couple of times. It's just so contagious. Yeah, whenever anyone comes in with it, we wipe everything down. And I have to say, most of the time we're very caring for our patients, but if someone comes in with adenovirus, they're in and out very quickly.
Yeah, well, the doctor didn't know anything about this castellated sarcoma either, so that's why I ended up going to an ophthalmologist. So.
Yeah, all right.
One thing led to another. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay. No
good
worries.
On you. Bye-bye. Yes, no, very good to talk with you as well, and all the best. Now, we've managed to repair our text line. Just a few texts. Is it common to need reading glasses and long-distance glasses in your 40s?
Yeah, well, for a subset of the population, unfortunately. So if you're long-sighted and you're young enough, that lens inside the eye that becomes a cataract is strong enough to allow you to see in the distance and read up close without needing glasses. And unfortunately, you're going along mind your own business, and when you hit your 40s, it packs it in and loses its strength. And the first thing that goes is typically your reading vision gets much harder. And if you're unlucky enough to be long-sighted enough, your distance vision goes as well. And suddenly you go from never having an eye check in your life to visiting your optometrist every year, and you sit there and you think, what have you done?
Yeah. I'm one of those who, and apparently there's lots of us, who improved, actually. I couldn't see far, so I had to have glasses to watch a movie. If I went to the cinema, for example, and driving, I certainly needed glasses. But as I got older, that improved, actually. I don't need glasses to do that anymore, but I do need glasses to read. Yeah. So it actually, I mean, the shape of your lens does change, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the eye is growing throughout life. Most of the growth's when you're younger, but yeah, it does change its shape for sure, and the cornea changes its shape over time, and the lens changes its power.
Will says, what does one green eye and one blue eye mean?
Yes.
Can that happen?
Yeah. It's got a fancy term called heterochromia, which just means different coloured eyes.
Uh-huh.
Some people are born with it, with nothing interesting associated with that. Sometimes you can develop it if for instance, you're on glaucoma drops in one eye, not the other, then that eye will go darker than the other eye. Occasionally, it can be due to growth on the surface of the eye. Typically, it'd be much darker than green.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some genetic conditions that are also associated with anisocoria.
Hmm.
Oh, sorry, heterochromia. Sorry.
Okay, Hal's on the line from Dwellingup. Hi, Hal.
Thank you, Phil. Steve, I'm told that I will need operation for cataracts in a few years. I'm 72. I wear glasses for distance and for reading vision, and the doc said, we can fix both. And I said, don't you lose depth perception if you have only one eye for the distance and one for reading? And for reading at the moment, I've got both multifocal and ordinary bifocals. The bifocals, you need to hold your book at a certain distance to see. You can't bring it any closer if it's small. So if you got any recommendations or the pros and cons of choosing between both eyes for distance and having to wear glasses, or one eye for distance and one for reading?
Sure, sure, Hal. Yeah, look, it's a bugbear, isn't it? Because Phil and I have been talking about needing to use reading glasses as you get older, and then you get cataracts, and suddenly ophthalmologists, we promise the world.
Yeah.
Look, I think it's worth being realistic to say that even with the best intentions, we don't always achieve what we're aiming for. So.
Yeah.
So that's one thing to take into consideration. You're quite right. The depth perception can be affected by having what we call monovision, one eye up close and one for distance.
Yeah.
There are multifocal lenses that you can have placed, which potentially could get around that. But
multifocal cataract replacement.
Multifocal intraocular lenses, yeah. But,
all right.
But they themselves have their own issues with increasing in glare. And if you do a lot of driving at night, sometimes you get... sort of halos around lights.
Yes.
Everything's a compromise. If you want your absolute best vision, then having both eyes set for distance and having a good pair of multifocals would probably give you the best vision.
Right.
But if you want the most, but if you want vision that's pretty good but very convenient, then monovision for a lot of people works extremely well. And if your cataracts aren't too bad, you can almost try that out with a sort of contact lens that works for up close. But look, it's one of those things. It's worth seeing what you need in terms of what tasks are most important to you, and working out what your trade-off is. Because there's a trade-off with everything. We can't place a lens inside your eye that works the same as the lens when you were young. Yeah, when we can, we'll be even more impressive.
Yes, yes.
All right.
So I'll ask lots more questions, and when I finally come around to it, I hope I'll. I have the information I need to make decisions for the best part. Thanks, Steve.
Good luck, Hal.
Best luck, Hal. Best of luck, Hal.
Thank you, Phil.
Good on you. Bye-bye. Jacinta, hello.
Hello.
Hello, Jacinta.
I wanted to ask you, I have had a corneal graft in my left eye and have also had cataract surgery on my eye. And I see different, in each eye, I see different shades of colour. And I wondered about that. Do you know anything about that? It's brighter in the one that I've had the cataract. Like I can see the brighter colours.
Right. So you've had cataract surgery in just one eye?
Yeah, just one eye.
Yeah, yeah. And how old are you, Jacinta?
I'm 57.
Okay. And the eye that you've had the cataract in is also the eye that's got the corneal graft?
Yeah, the same one.
Yeah, so what cataracts? Cataracts are interesting. So we talk about them reducing your clarity of vision. But they actually take blue out of the system. So the cataracts are kind of a brownish hue, and they filter out blue light.
Ah.
And what that means is that if you're looking at a bright blue sky out of the eye that's had the cataract operation, it's usually brilliantly blue. But if you look out of the eye with a cataract in it, it's a little bit muddier, a little bit off colour. So that's probably what you're noticing. You're probably noticing the cataract in your non-operated eye now.
Oh, yes, you're right. Oh, yes, that'd be right, because it has self need to be done. Oh, yeah. Okay, that's really cool.
So once you've had it done, it'll all balance out, hopefully.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting. Oh, good, thank you. I've always wondered.
Thanks, Jacinta. Bye-bye. Back to a few texts. What is the effect of young people using screens all the time? Is there any evidence that it's bad?
Yes, I mean, I, as a parent, I'd like to say yes. whether it's bad for your eyes or just bad for your socialising, I'm not sure. But, look, The thing about using screens and staying indoors more and not getting out in the sunshine is there is some good evidence to suggest that you become more short-sighted. So kids that go out and play outside in the sun, that's protective against short-sightedness, interestingly enough.
Hmm. Okay. What's the latest on pterygiums? Can they be treated? Should they be treated? When should they be treated?
Yes, I actually quite like pterygium surgery now. I never used to because it was really painful for patients.
I was always advised, I mean, I've got one myself, that it wasn't very successful surgery because they tend to grow back.
Yeah, no, look, we do pretty well these days. Mm-hmm. I have to say the recurrence rate's probably less than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests that most people do well. And it used to be quite a painful operation, but with the use of a contact lens as a Band-Aid for the eye, which usually leave in for up to a week, that takes away most of the pain with the operation. It's still a little bit uncomfortable. I used to get called the next night every time. Mm. The partner of the patient I'd operated on would be saying, "Can you please help? They're crying in tears. I've never seen a grown man cry like this." Mm. Whereas these days, I just don't get that phone call anymore. So the contact lens makes a huge difference. And we used to stitch them in. Nowadays, we glue the pterygium in and they recover so much faster.
Hmm.
So it's an operation that definitely does better these days, Phil. But yeah, like all operations, if you've got a pterygium, it doesn't mean you have to have it removed.
That's right. It's not of itself detrimental to your eye, is it?
There are some people who need a pterygium removed because it's threatening the part of your cornea where you see through. So,
yep.
And in that situation, yes. But the vast majority of them we can watch.
Hmm. Stephen Preston says, "I'm colourblind red-brown. Why am I colourblind?" I don't know.
I'm red-green. I'm not sure. I'm sure about red-brown.
Is glaucoma hereditary?
Yes, yeah.
Says Fee and Bernie.
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. There are some families where it's very strongly associated with a certain gene, but even when it's not, it does run in families very strongly. Yeah, so if other members of your family have got glaucoma, it's very important you get checked.
Mm. Mike in Cairns says, "Hi, guys. Read the heart and the eyes being connected. I have an angiogram yearly and always have migraine-like auras for about a week afterwards. No headache, just really out-of-focus eyes. Takes me longer to recover each year." There we go.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But back to what we were talking about. Where are we? We've got time for a couple more calls too. Jeff on the line from Perth. G'day, Jeff.
Oh, good evening, Phil.
Hi.
Yes, look, just a quick question. Thanks for your program. Look, I was wondering whether there'd been any development in for people with lazy eyes. We all know it's a neurological problem and not an eye problem. I had a patch, like most, up until after the age of six, but of course you've got to get the patch on before the age of six to correct the lazy eye. Has there been any development in that world?
Yeah, good question, Jeff. I think that we used to be very hard and fast about the age six or seven, where if you don't patch up until that age, you're never going to get any improvement. And there's been some studies that show that you can patch people who are older than that and still get improvement. So it's worth bearing in mind that's possible. So the visual system, like the rest of the brain, is still plastic even when you get older. Of course, it's much more effective if you patch when people are younger. Young kids respond so much better to treatment. There's not been any medicine we've come up with that can reset that switch. So we haven't found a way to cure you of a lazy eye. But yeah, it's not impossible to try patching again. But I think, you know, obviously you'd have to figure your chances of it working as you get older become less.
Yep. Okay, thank you. That was my
suspicion.
Sorry, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Keep
it good. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. John from Queanbeyan. G'day, John.
Good evening, Philip. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
May I speak to the surgeon, Phil?
Yes, you may. Dr. Steve Colley's here.
Hi, Doctor. Dr. Colley.
Hi, John.
I just wanted to ask you about my right eye. In 2013, I had an accident in my right eye, which tore my tear duct out.
Yes.
They repaired it at... I went under surgery in Calvary Hospital here in Canberra, and about 6 months later, there was no drainage in my right eye, and I went back and had it looked at, and they said that they tried to irrigate, and they said that the stitches had dropped out and I lost the tube.
Yep.
Anyways, since then, I've been for three operations up at the Sydney Eye Hospital to rectify this problem, and it was just a pure irrigation problem. Now, in this last operation, which was done 3 months ago, the cancer tube, I think they put a Jones tube in.
Yes.
And now when I blow my nose, the air just gushes out to the right corner of my eye.
Yeah.
So I've got to, at the moment, to blow my nose, I've got to put compression on my right eye for the air to stop coming out. And I'm just wondering, is this a problem that cannot be fixed? Or
I mean that's a good question. It's probably, I don't have enough experience to really give you a definitive answer, except to say that once the tear ducts have been completely damaged, the only way to provide adequate drainage is with a prosthesis like the Jones tube that you've got in there.
But am I right to say, doctor, that, you know, I'm just talking about carpentry way, you think they've drilled a hole too big or what? Because why is this air gushing out?
Yeah, so normally when you sneeze or blow your nose, there are little valves in the system that prevent the air from refluxing up into your eyes. And some people naturally don't have those valves, and they can kind of do all sorts of crazy things and blow it.
This Jones tube seems to be quite huge, because if I put my little finger into the corner of my eye, I can actually feel like a plastic thing there.
Yeah.
And my eyes are—it's still not irrigating properly, and this Jones tube takes a bit of it away.
Yeah.
But the rest of my eye just overflows, and then this gush of air, which is absolutely terrible.
Yeah, and I look.
And it's causing a lot of irritation in my eye, because I don't know if it's when I blow my nose, if any of the stuff from my nose is coming out into my eye.
Yeah, look, I suspect it's probably just air that's blowing out, but yes, it'd definitely be worth having a chat to the doctors up in Sydney to talk about that. And it may be that they can size a different size tube there that will give you less trouble.
All right.
Okay.
But in your opinion, you think it could be rectified, possibly?
Oh, look, I just don't think I don't know enough about that to be able to help.
Anyway, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks, John. Good luck, enjoy John. Thank you. Good luck, and good luck too. Norm reckons taking fish oil is good for dry eyes. Any evidence for that?
Yeah. I think omega-3 fatty acids are meant to be particularly useful for a condition called blepharitis, which is inflammation of the eyelids, and that disturbs your tear film and can certainly give you make your dry eye worse.
Lynn's an occupational therapist. Please comment on current research around bifocals contributing to older folk having increased falls risks, especially if they have some cognitive decline.
Yes, no, I think that's a good point. So the problem with bifocals is that the power of your glasses gets greater as you go down the spectacle. So, and it's, I guess, a similar effect for people to think about. It would be like when you look into a pool and you look at someone in a pool, their legs look shorter. So that change in the light going through the bottom of the glasses changes where everything is. So the steps are in the wrong place. So bifocal glasses for sure, a higher rate of falls. And that's another one of those things. Cataract surgery has certainly been shown to reduce the number of falls elderly folk have, and that might be as one of the reasons. It may be that they don't have to walk around with glasses quite so much, less likely to trip over because of their bifocals, as one of the reasons, Phil.
Okay, all right. Steve, it's been a tremendous pleasure having you in and having your expertise as well. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Phil.
Dr. Steve Colley is an ophthalmologist. He's head of department at Fremantle Hospital, and he has been here answering questions about eyes. Hope you found that useful, and if you did today, that you found something to take away as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.